We'll hear argument now in the case of United States against Strobel. Mr. Henderson.
Hello, may it please the court. I'm Peter Henderson. I represent Jeremy Strobel in this case. This is a pretty straightforward issue of error correction. The district judge did not orally impose part of the sentence. He did not orally impose or adopt or impose by reference any conditions of supervised release. We think the law is pretty clear. The recent Rogers case in the Fourth Circuit mirrors this case, and there's no reason to deviate from the court's longstanding precedent on this type of issue. So we would ask that the court vacate those conditions on the written judgment as inconsistent and remand. I did want to clarify our request.
Is this some kind of magic words argument? The judge asked counsel whether he had any concerns about the PSR's proposal, whether he wanted the conditions read, whether there were any objections. Counsel said, no, no, no. Is there then some magic formula that has to follow? Something like, and I hereby impose what you've just agreed to?
There are no magic words, but there is this concept. I think linguists would call it a performative utterance, where at a sentencing hearing, a judge's words have the effect of changing the legal status or the legal rights of a party. And so the judge has to say something to affect that change in the party's status. And so it's not enough to say, do you have any objection to me doing this? The judge then needs to do it. So it's not a magic word. I hereby impose this. The judge could have said, okay.
Sounds like you're saying, I understand that there may be a technical error. I agree that it's totally harmless. I agree that what the judge didn't say, everybody in the courtroom understood. And please don't pay any attention to the harmless error doctrine. I mean, that seems a very strange approach.
Well, the error is not harmless because the judgment imposes conditions that were not imposed at sentencing. And so the judgment would be different if, in light of the error, if the error is recognized.
I don't understand how the judgment would be different. What you're saying is the judge didn't do the performative utterance that he should have done before the judgment. And had he done that, the judgment would have been exactly what it is.
Correct, but he did not do that. And so his error in not doing that is not harmless because it means that Mr. Strobel now has all of these conditions of supervised release that were not imposed at sentencing.
Yes, but he would have had them even had the judge said the magic words.
Correct, but that's the error. It's not that the error did not affect the judgment, which would be what a harmless error is. The error directly affected the judgment. It led to a judgment that does not match the oral pronouncement of sentencing. But I understand. Look, I get the concern. My position or Mr. Strobel's position is this is just a fundamental issue that judges need to conform to at sentencing. It involves the right to be present at sentencing, the right to know exactly what you're sentenced to. It's not exactly magic words, but it is a requirement that the judge impose the sentence in person to the defendant while he's in the courtroom.
Fundamentally any different from the arguments we hear all the time in Rule 11 cases, where there's a list of things the judge should say in open court. But if he doesn't say them, we are apt to say, yeah, but it was perfectly clear to everybody that the defendant was waiving his right to a trial. That's what a guilty plea does. You don't have to say the words, even though the rule expressly requires those words.
It is different from the Rule 11 context because the judge does have to accept the guilty plea. So if the judge goes through the whole Rule 11 colloquy and the defendant enters a plea of guilty and it's never accepted, it doesn't have to be accepted in person. It can be accepted by a written order. So it's not quite analogous. But the judge has to take a certain legal action in order to effectuate a judgment of conviction against the person. So how you arrive at that in the Rule 11 context, there are all sorts of harmless errors. But it's the legal action that is important. In the Rule 11 context, it would be the acceptance of the guilty plea. And that has to happen. I don't think it would be harmless if the judge did not accept a guilty plea, but sentenced somebody anyway. And in the sentencing context, you have to orally impose all parts of the sentence. I think that rule is, frankly, very well established.
Does Mr. Strobel realize that if the judge revisits the consecutive nature of the sentence, that could lead him to reconsider the length of the sentence, for example?
He does. It's one of those requests that we've made because of information that he only learned after sentencing from his jailer that, you know, he could have been eligible for this Wisconsin program where he would have only served 3 out of 6 years and then engaged in sort of an intensive drug program and been released to extended supervision. He would like the chance to make that argument, but he certainly understands that there are risks in upsetting what is a below guideline sentence, although it is consecutive. But that's what we're asking the court to fashion its mandate as, is to just permit Judge Peterson to make that discretionary call. We certainly don't think there's a legal basis to require him to revisit the issue or to force him to rule a certain way, but we would like for Judge Peterson to have the authority under the mandate to revisit that decision if he feels it appropriate. Apart from that, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Stephen.
Thank you. Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Corey Stephan. I represent the United States in this case. Here, the district court intended to impose and adopt the supervised release conditions that were discussed at sentencing and incorporated by reference. At the sentencing, the court referenced those conditions by specifically stating the mandatory conditions 1 through 15, and then, as discussed here today, did go over those conditions with Mr. Strobel's attorney. The court asked if there were any concerns with those conditions, and the court noted that there were no objections previously filed. The defense had no objection. The defendant waived reading of those conditions and also said that he needed no further justification. And the court, I think, had made clear that treatment concerns were a motivating and driving factor in terms of the sentence in this case. And to the extent that the court did not use the words adopt or impose, I think just as Judge Easterbrook had mentioned, that we are kind of getting into a magic words territory here. And at the very most, this was an oversight in sentencing, but it does not affect the substance of what happened. While the language that the judge may have used may have been vague and ambiguous, what the judge intended was clear, and everyone at the sentencing clearly understood the conditions that were going to be imposed. The oral pronouncement in Mr. Strobel's case, while vague and ambiguous, is therefore properly clarified by the judgment in this case. And the defendant
Would the government be opposed to us leaving it to Judge Peterson's discretion whether to revisit whether the sentence in this case should run consecutively to the state sentence in view of the eligibility criteria for the state drug program and in view of the fact that Judge Peterson, you know, gave him the sentence that he did, hoping that it, you know, would help in some way with his drug problem?
Well, I would, Your Honor, I'd stand on our brief in the matter, but I think that that argument was not fully developed to the point where it really is anything more than speculation at this point. I think the primary argument that the government makes at this juncture is that the judgment and conviction should be affirmed in this case, so it shouldn't go back at all. To the extent that it is a secondary issue Again, the government stands on its brief and thinking that it's not appropriate that that be addressed. Although I think it was very clear from the court's sentencing statements that the court wanted some incremental punishment. In the appendix, the transcript, the court mentioned that incremental punishment is warranted because the gun was not reflected in the state sentence. The court also went under the guidelines significantly in fashioning the sentence. So that's an adequate response to Your Honor on that question.
I guess your answer to my question is no.
Yes. No. With all due respect.
It, of course. How could it be otherwise? Look, I agree with you that it seems obvious that Judge Peterson intended to impose the conditions of supervised release that were proposed in the PSR, but he didn't actually pronounce any conditions or state his intent to do so. Seems to me that we have an omission rather than an ambiguity in the court's oral statements. And doesn't that require us to remand?
Well, the government's position is that the court incorporated by reference those conditions, which the case law permits. The court specifically said, I didn't get any objections on the conditions. The ones that are proposed are the mandatory conditions and conditions 1 through 15. The court is not required to read them. It can orally incorporate them from the PSR. And when the defendant was asked if the court should read those conditions, the defense attorney on the defendant's behalf said no. And at the beginning of the transcript, the court had clearly asked the defendant that he read the pre-sentence report and the addendum and the revised pre-sentence report. And he had an opportunity to discuss those documents with his lawyer. The judge asked, have you done that? The defendant said, yes, Your Honor. So everyone knew what was in there. And when the court talked about these conditions, specifically the mandatory conditions and conditions 1 through 15, it was specifically referencing the pre-sentence report. And so to that extent, I think that the court properly incorporated them by reference. So the extension of this argument here is obviously that to the extent that there's any vagueness or ambiguity in the sentence, the oral pronouncement is properly clarified by the judgment in this case. The court's written statement confirms that the court adopted the PSR without any changes. And in the judgment, the court writes, I adopt conditions numbers 1 through 15 as proposed and justified in the pre-sentence report. So the defendant, in closing, the defendant had adequate notice of these conditions. He had an adequate opportunity to object to them. They were incorporated by reference on the record. It was clear that the court intended to adopt those conditions, and I think that the court did so in this matter, obviously falling short of the lacking those words adopt or impose. But where there is no conflict between the oral pronouncement and the written judgment, and the government's position is there is no conflict in this case, there is simply an ambiguity. The written judgment.
I understand that you want us to construe the written judgment as clarifying an ambiguity in the court's oral comments, but there is no ambiguity in the court's remarks at sentencing. There is simply an absence of any stated intent as to the conditions of release. And in this situation, I don't know, I might just not know what I'm talking about, but it seems to me that the written judgment can't fill in what the court neglected to address at sentencing.
I would agree if the judge, the district court simply did not talk about those conditions at all, and there was just an absence, I think, or if the court had made a statement, something to the effect of, and you'll have to abide by conditions. If you don't, you'll get revoked. But that more is kind of the implication that I think some of the cases have found is improper. But here it's the judge is specifically referencing them, specifically referencing the fact that there's no objections to them. The government's position is in this case, the court did everything but say those magic words, adopt or impose, such that the intent, I think, is clear. So, barring any additional questions of the court, the government's position is that we would ask that this court affirm the judgment and conviction in this case, and we otherwise stand on our brief. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Henderson?
Only if the panel has questions.
All right, well, you have asked, so I'll ask you one. The statute says that terms and conditions of supervised release can be set at any time. That means that it isn't necessary to set them orally at the time of sentencing. Why doesn't one say simply, okay, the district court neglected to do that on the date of sentencing, but he did it later, which is at any time.
So you mean he imposed them as part of the written judgment, and that is at a later time? Am I understanding that correctly?
It is at any time, which is what the statute says.
Okay, so there are a couple problems with that. One is that the rules of criminal procedure guarantee that a defendant has the right to be present or have a hearing if conditions are going to be imposed that were not previously imposed. And so it can't be done in his...
He was there at his sentencing. He doesn't have a right, as I understand it, to be present when terms and conditions are formally changed later.
He does, I believe it's Rule 32.1, but he does have a right to be present or to at least have the opportunity to object and have a hearing if the modification of the conditions
we're back to my initial question. We know that the defendant didn't object. Indeed, he consented to all of these terms.
Right. And look, on the equities, I understand sort of the situation that Mr. Strubble is in. It really is about the rule of law and what are this sort of, how do you impose a criminal sentence is construed strictly. Because of all the concerns that we've identified in our brief, one remedy that the court might consider is to say, look, Mr. Strubble's asked to go back to the district court for resentencing. We're just going to strike the conditions, and the district court can impose these new conditions when Mr. Strubble's released, right? So that at any time language could be used in that situation. The court's normal procedure in these types of cases is just to remand it to get it out of the way up front, not burden district judges who may have been replaced in the meantime or retired, what have you. Just get it over with at the beginning so that the defendant knows what he's facing when he comes out. But certainly the statute would permit the court just to say, we're going to strike these conditions. They weren't imposed correctly. And we trust that the district court will address them when Mr. Strubble's released. But we think our remedy is superior, and we would, of course, ask for the opportunity to address the drug program issue. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.